You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 444. Securing distribution is always a battle, said every filmmaker ever.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, today on the show, guys, we have film distribution expert Orly Ravid. Now, Orly has been in the film distribution space for a long time and is the founder of the Film Collaborative, where she has been fighting the good fight, trying to help filmmakers get distribution and navigate the shark-infested world that is film distribution. Her organization launched a best-selling book called Selling Your Film Without Selling Your Soul, and more recently, How Not to Sign a Film Contract. The Film Collaborative is the first nonprofit focused on distribution education, and uses three taglines that really encompasses what she believes in: filmmakers first, nonprofit on purpose, and we don't own the rights, you do. Now, Orly and I sat down and had an amazing conversation about film distribution in today's world, what's going on with coronavirus, and how that's affecting the world, and what we as filmmakers can do to get our films out there, because things are changing so rapidly. Amazon is dropping documentaries now and no short films. And, you know, these platforms have just so much power, and we need to figure out what we can do as filmmakers to make a living doing what we love. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Orly Ravid. I'd like to welcome to the show Orly Ravid. How are you doing, Orly?
I'm well. How are you?
As good as I can be in this crazy mixed up world that we live in. So thank you so much for being on the show. How we have not met officially over the years, since considering we're both our good friend Shaked, who introduced us finally, he's like, we need to build an Avengers team of distribution, you know, fighters, and like, you know, Orly will be on it, I'll be on it, you should be on it, Alex. I was like, that would be awesome. So how we have not literally crossed paths in all the stuff that we do individually is beyond me, but it's a small world. So
well, you know, what's funny is, as soon as Shaked introduced us, and then obviously we met, and all of a sudden it was like when you learn a new word and you see it everywhere, then all of a sudden we're like, oh yeah, did you hear the new Indie Film Hustle Podcast and the, you know, latest episode? And I was like, yep.
Yeah. It's yeah, exactly. My wife, all of a sudden, she's like, is it just me? There's a lot of Teslas around. I'm like, she was like thinking of like, oh, I just looked at one the other day. And I'm like, yeah, I'm like, that'd be nice, babe, but not yet.
Come down.
Yeah, well, she wants the big station wagon one. The one. Oh. Yeah, she wants the station wagon one for the family. I'm like, give me a minute.
Yoda needs his own row, his own.
Obviously, Yoda, my co-pilot in life, sir. So first of all, how did you get in the business?
Oh, that's a fun question. I mean, when I studied in college, I did take film courses that weren't business related, but they were more sort of critical theory and screenwriting. And I did internships, they call them, that were film related, but I wasn't in the business and I didn't ever think that I would be in the business. And then I moved from Manhattan from Manhattan, New York to California, although I did a quick stint in Chicago on the way. Had other film involvements, but the first job that I ever took in distribution in this town was with a international sales company. And I just thought I was going to be their office manager. That was the job that I took. I had done some film festival programming work at Outfest and at the Israeli Film Festival, mm-hmm. but that was my first like job in the industry that wasn't an internship. And the office management job turned into me creating and running the domestic distribution arm because my boss, the guy who owned the company, said, well, international sales was really hurt in the Asian crisis back in the days of, you know, after the 80s boom. And I really need some business revenue to offset any downturns in international sales. And so could you help me launch this domestic distribution arm, which I did. And back then there was VHS. So mm-hmm. All those things. That's how I got started in the biz, as it were.
Yes. And then after VHS, the boom of the DVD market, which was, oh man, the money was flowing, wasn't it? Oh.
Yeah. And so I did VHS, I did DVDs, all of that stuff. And I also still did international sales. That's how I learned both aspects of the business. And at the time, folks were like, oh, you're such a go-getter. You should be an agent. But I decided not to be an agent.
I think smart move. And for people listening, you have to understand, like, when the DVD boom was happening, that's when you can make Sniper 6 and 7 and just pre-sell it. It was just done. Like, all you needed to do was put it out and it was 3 to 5 million guaranteed.
Yeah. And that time was so lucrative for the business to business folks. That's when, you know, deals were done on napkins and can, and it wasn't weird to have big parties, and it was just the cost of doing business because a lot of business was being generated and a lot of money was flowing, at least to those folks in the business.
Yeah, right. Not to the filmmakers as much.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. Let me ask you that question because, you know, I've been yelling from the top of the mountain for a while now that I feel that the system has the film distribution side of the business has a systemic problem that has been there pretty much since the inception of the industry, where distributors and the distribution contracts and the way that whole traditional model is set up not to pay really, or not to take care of the artist, not to take care of the filmmaker. I mean, I remember, was it Chaplin and Fairbanks and Pickford? They opened up United Artists because they kept getting screwed out of the business side of things. It's been going on forever. Do you think I don't think it's getting any better. Do you? I mean, there's more knowledge out there, but I don't think it's getting any better. And why is it? Why is it that way? Because you've been in the business for a while.
So I'll answer the why it is that way first, which is, you know, American culture is very commercially focused. We don't support our arts in this country with government and public funds generally. I mean, there's mm-hmm. some exceptions, and we don't treat distribution as a mission. We treat it as a business, and people in business, I mean, you know, they're billionaires buying up mobile home parks and evicting the tenants, you know, their landlord, you know, the people who ratchet mm-hmm. up rent. I mean, big business is big business, and that's, just a culture that we're in. And with film, I think the disconnect for folks is that because independent films feel like they're doing artwork, you know, working to do something important, artistically important, culturally important, that it should be treated differently. And I agree that it should be. But if you're going to do a deal with a traditional commercial distributor, I mean, they're not obviously all the same, but certainly the model is oriented to make money for the distributor. And, right. you know, and take rights for a very long time and that kind of thing. And it's just a different system here that we have. Or Walmart, or sorry, just to, you know, mm-hmm. The way Walmart approaches its vendors, you know, push very hard to get the best price. And if we don't sell it, you're going to take it back, right? The business is taking care of itself.
Got it. And it's just the brutal nature of this, at least this in America. And I know the UK is not too far behind that. There's a lot of guys doing that kind of deal. But internationally, because you worked internationally as well, is it different with distribution deals? Or is it like, you know, when you're in Cannes or at AFM, I mean, these deals are similar in overseas, like in France or in Germany or in other major places. Is that just a general way of the business is done, period?
Well, yeah. I mean, the all rights distributor deals in Europe and in Asia can be for just as long of a term, you know, and there can be similar accounting issues. Certainly, we've noticed that. but at the same time, the difference is a lot of the European films are financed by public funds. And frankly, the filmmakers are not so worried about, as long as the distribution happens, they're not always as worried about getting the money back. So, and then there, you know, there are public broadcasters that are funded by public funds, and even sales companies that can get public support, like in France and stuff. So, but I will, because you had a second part of the question that I didn't yet answer, which is, I think it is getting better, not because necessarily distributors are going to, well, there's two things. I think there is a movement that I'd like to think that I'm part of having started, which is creating other distribution opportunities for filmmakers that are not deleterious, that are not going to be harmful. And I think that different ethos and that different push for more transparency and for better terms has shifted the market a little bit, because there are services that accommodate that. You know, for example, I love working with Giant Entertainment. I think they're an example of a way to get VOD distribution done without giving your rights away for a really long time. But also the fact that, you know, there's a bunch of distribution folks can do themselves, right? People are booking theaters themselves. People mm-hmm. are, you know, getting someone on their team to do it, or hiring a service. People can get onto VOD platforms through aggregators, which is a much safer way. There's obviously the marketing question there. But in other words, what before distribution was so much more cost intensive, there was also a barrier to entry for the filmmakers, right? Mm-hmm. It was to make 35 millimeter prints. It was expensive to traffic them. It was expensive to, and it was, you know, gatekeeping, and you weren't going to be booking theaters yourself. Although I think Cassavetes did it. So I guess you could have done it. One could mm-hmm. have done it. Even in the 70s, but now it's a lot less expensive to make the movie. It's also a lot less expensive to distribute it. And I'm not talking about, you know, $100 million campaign, you know, on a few thousand screens, but just for the, you know, an indie film. And that happens all the time. There's service deals, right? So the model, there's plenty of those opportunities where you can just pay for a service to help you accomplish your goals, and you'll have more control and ownership and keep your ownership of the rights.
So we're obviously in the middle of a once in a generation pandemic, which is obviously ravaging not only our industry, but the world. But specifically in our industry, how do you see COVID affecting distributors moving forward? Because my feeling is that the financial pressure hasn't even begun yet. In my feeling, I think it's going to get a little bit worse. And I feel that a lot of these distributors, especially the predatory ones, will become more predatory in regards to it. And again, not all. There are good, and I always say this, there are good distributors out there, but a lot of them, these deals are very predatory. And we could talk about predatory deals that are just, oh my God, like, I'm sure you've read a couple over the years. Like, how is this legal? You know, but how do you see?
Over the years, but I mean, I've been involved with, you know, because I'm an attorney, I've helped clients sue their distributor. Well, I don't disagree that, you know, there's going to be an even greater desperation to have distribution on the part of filmmakers who, you know, there's just also just so much more. I mean, I also think filmmakers are kind of going into this, not always being educated about, you know, what distribution is, how to get it, when it can work and when it can't. Not every film has a big audience, right? And that's just the truth. I will say that distributors that I know and do deals with are seeing a surge in home entertainment consumption, right? I mean, VOD generally is, I think, up 40%. So there's a lot of positive impact in just in terms of extra consumption. There's also more content than has ever been produced before. And and the buyers are more and more commercially oriented. And there's more emphasis on series and less on independent film. So that's the plus. You know, I think it depends on what you're creating, that you may even have more opportunities than you would have before. In terms of, though, theatrical and having an impact there, it's obviously tremendously diminished. Festivals, the ability for a film to break out and launch out of a festival is tremendously diminished. I mean, I'm so fascinated to see what happens at Sundance this year, right? Mm-hmm. A virtual festival, I guess there's some live components, and there'll be virtual festivals for months to come. So I think that it creates a glut, right? Films that were premieres at South By are meant to premiere again. And it is definitely stacking the competition times several fold, right? Because there's that many more films going to try to compete at the same time,
right?
For attention and for distribution. And I think that's hard. And I don't know what else to say about it, but I think it's going to be. And as far as predatory, people should not sign deals with distributors without checking, right? You've got your podcast and your Facebook group, and we are going to rejigger our distributor report card early next year.
Can you tell me what the report card is?
Yeah, we have a suite of digital distribution, educational free services. One is the Digital Distribution Guide, which is a guide to platforms around the world that, if you made a certain kind of film, you can see what platforms are available that take the film. And then there's case studies. And then there's a very information rich blog and our social media. All that stuff is free information is oriented to VOD and distribution that oriented VOD and reverse. The distributor report card is the only thing that I started that I didn't successfully finish at the Film Collaborative, because it was meant to be the Yelp for distribution.
Right.
Having transparent information from filmmakers who experienced distributors. Mm-hmm. It was very hard. People just didn't want to comment, didn't want to share, even when they could be anonymous. So we're doing it differently now. We're kind of just going to interview distributors as well to get their representation of what they do and what they do well and what they're looking for, but also comments from filmmakers about what went well, what didn't go well, and sort of synthesizing that. So instead of it being anonymous filmmaker X, right, or naming, we're just going to synthesize it all, and then I just have my own years of experience, right? And it's not black and white. There's some distributors who are perfectly fine at this, that, and the other thing, but not the best at this, or know going right into this deal that this is what it ultimately is. And then there are other distributors that are flat out predatory and never do a deal with them. Straight up, don't do it.
Yeah, because I've been trying to figure out a way to do something like a Yelp for distributors, because that's been coming up constantly in the Facebook group. They're like, hey, is there a place where we can just go see if this is? And our Facebook group is a good reference and resource, because people just type in I'm like, look, just type in the name of the distributor and the search, and people will let you know. It's not hard to do research on distributors. I mean, you just got to call a few filmmakers up, and they are very honest about it.
Exactly. I always tell every filmmaker, don't just take my opinion about what I know, my data points. Call filmmakers, not just the ones the distributor told you to call, but other ones. And usually you'll hear. But I also think it's to know how to receive the information. I mean, that's part of where hearing the distributor's perspective is also useful. It's like what they're actually able to deliver and what they're promising versus what's not, they're going to do and no one is going to do. Right. And so, you got to get real about what's available in the marketplace as far as distribution for small films. Right. But then there's just the flat out predatory ones where it doesn't matter. Just don't do that deal. And I would love to, love to collaborate with you and anyone else on Expand. This is a free service that's just meant to collate.
Yeah.
Real experiences that filmmakers have had, and across the top, we're going to focus on the US first, the top 25 to 40 companies. Right. Not the top, the biggest, but rather the most commonly at issue in indie film.
Yes, there's a couple of, I beat up on distributors, especially the predatory distributors a lot. But to be fair, a lot of filmmakers go into a distribution deal with very unreasonable expectations, because like I say, there's never an ugly baby. There are no ugly babies in the world. And that's the same thing with film. But unfortunately, the truth is, yes, there are ugly babies. And filmmakers don't want to hear that they just spent a year and a half making an ugly baby. And they don't want to hear that. And then, of course, who are they going to blame? They're going to blame the distributor, whether it's their fault or not. So that there is that. Do you agree with that?
Oh, 100%. And I asked myself, or not, I don't only ask myself, I ask them. I mean, you're choosing the most expensive art medium in the world as less expensive as it is now than it's been. It's always been more expensive than poetry and painting and, you know, and playing instruments and everything else. So, you know, and you're usually not just using your own money. You're usually using other people's money. And so if you're just going to give, if you're going to have a business plan around your film that's only looking at the most successful films with anything similar, but really not a fair comparison with respect to cast or budget or genre or time of
when it was released.
Right. Well, I mean, genre, they usually kind of
align
in terms of a business plan, but yeah, or time when it was released, right? It was released in the heyday of the 80s when, you know, we just talked about that, or in the 90s, which had its own boom. You know, the difference between then and now is that there's a lot less business to business guaranteed transactions. Like when VHS and then DVD were new, the stores needed stuff and they were going to buy anyway. And now you just don't have that. In fact, now you have so much data that the platforms have themselves. They simply only license what they, you know, iTunes, anyone can get onto iTunes without, you know, them curating you, if provided you meet the tech specs and other criteria like that. But it doesn't mean you'll sell a goddamn.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And Amazon's purging right now. They're purging. Like just whenever they feel like it, like, nope, sorry. And you're just gone because they don't care. They don't care. They're selling socks. They make more money selling socks than they do dealing with independent filmmakers.
Well, and they tried, let's get real. They tried to do an independent film initiative with the Festival Stars program. And it didn't last because it wasn't revenue generating enough. Presumably if it had been, they would have kept it going. Right. Yeah. And so that's the other thing, is like to be realistic about, you know, at Film Collaborative, we really try to help folks get clear about where they are in the landscape. If you've made a film that would be a studio film, if only it had a much bigger budget, a top director who's, you know, famous and A-list cast, well, but you haven't made that. You've made this other thing that, you know, how are people going to know it exists and what's going to motivate them to watch it? And then the answer is, you know, sometimes it's extraordinary and it's a breakout and that's a great thing. And an A-list festival can help get you there. And sometimes that happens even without that. But still, you know, what's the data around that? And the other thing is, filmmakers ask themselves, how many independent films do you view? Right? Like not studio films, not series, just small films from not famous people that you're just like discovering and paying for. Or, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so that's when people get really real about it. But again, I kind of don't, I have that scrutiny in that speech, but I also understand because they want to make their work, they're artists, and we don't have that kind of funding support in this country. They're just going to get it financed privately and then try to figure it out.
Right. And you said something earlier, and I want to kind of touch on this because there's a myth out there that I'd love for you to help me debunk, a TVOD. Transactional video on demand. Everyone thinks that all they need to do is go to an aggregator and put their films up on iTunes, Google, Amazon, and they will be discovered because their film is genius. And the world of TVOD, we'll get to SVOD and AVOD in a minute, but TVOD, and I have examples of films making $500,000, $3 million off a transactional. But two things have to happen. One of those examples was in 2010, and they were one of the first movies on iTunes, and they had a TV star in it, and they were two very popular directors. So that's the outskirts. But the other one is TVOD only works if you have an audience that you can drive to it that actually is willing to pay, purchase, or rent your film. That's the only way TVOD works, unless you're a studio. For independents, I feel that it's pretty much dead. What do you think?
I think you're right. Every distributor that I've talked to, they're not saying like it's completely dead. There's still business.
Oh no, trickles. So yeah.
Yeah. But it's just not the boon that it was for some in the beginning. Cause again, when cable VOD was a new thing, that was a big piece of business. And that was like the biggest part of video on demand revenue. And we were ahead of the whole world in terms of video on demand revenue. And then of course the transactional platforms like Apple and stuff like that. And, You know, there was a time when that was a reasonable amount of revenue for certain films with the marketing traction with the audience. Now it's completely really died down because there's just so much content available for no extra charge to the audience on, you know, that's streaming or AVOD. And, you know, people just don't feel the need to pay for anything other than, you know, the big studio stuff or maybe some stuff for kids where they want to be able to keep watching it and it's not on a streaming service. Or watch without ads, whatever it is. But it's very, yeah, the revenue now for independent films on TVOD is very low. It's the lowest it's ever been. There are exceptions, but they sort of prove the rule. I know that there's one film that a company is taking on that is, you know, very VOD focused. And that film is a low budget indie, but it happens to have people in it with huge social media followings that are very supportive, right? It's got to have that, or a niche, right? And I, you know, like Free Solo is a doc that I think did quite well on TV. Like it's got to have a thing, you know, sports enthusiasts, enthusiasts of a certain subculture, right? Where people really want to rent it and buy it. And that's all that's available at the time, right? There's the window created to make people to drive those sales. Yeah. If you don't have, if you're just that small, would be a studio movie if only had a bigger budget with a famous director. And you have no like clear marketing hook. Even the niches that used to be such a slam dunk, like LGBT, which, you know, I know a lot about. I've worked for two LGBT distributors. We have a lot of those films at Film Collaborative. I'm a lesbian, you know, like it's like something mm-hmm. I really know about. Mm-hmm. Even that is no longer like a slam dunk, like any movie will work well because the population is not desperate for the content anymore as it once was.
Right. So, yeah, because I mean, in my book, I talk about the power. The only power I feel that filmmakers have, especially small indies, is niche. That you can target an audience that is very passionate about a subject matter, and that cuts through a lot of marketing. That it'll cut through $100 million worth of marketing of the studio stuff. Because I always use the example: I'm a vegan, so when that Game Changers came up, yeah. I was just clamoring to see the Game Changers documentary when it came out. Which is about vegan athletes, which was brand new. No one had ever really done anything, or at least marketed properly. Yeah. And it did have some heavy hitters behind it. It had James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jackie Chan, and a couple other big executive producers behind it. But I was clamoring, and everything just wiped away all these other content. I was like, when is this release? And I paid for the rental. And then, of course, 3 weeks later, it was on Netflix. So I was like, son of a... But
they didn't tell you that.
But they didn't tell you that, right? And it was also, but I was also very passionate about that. So that is, I think, the only hope we have as independent filmmakers is to do, like LGBT is a subgenre. And if you're able to focus on that and target that audience and really build something that's of value to that audience, that's the only hope you have. You can't make a broad comedy anymore. You can't make a broad, you know, drama. At the indie level, low budget.
And by the way, Game Changers, you know, great example, but a lot of money went into that too. I mean, that movie was not marketed just with like grassroots. There was like
No, that's a big example, but I'm just using the concept of the niche.
Yeah, like, 100%. And yet I would say after you have a few movies within the niche, it's not enough to just make the movie in the niche. So that was a unique movie at the time, and I don't know if there's anything since, but there's for other niches, there are plenty of movies that are covering, you know, the subject. I mean, but there's plenty of different niches, you know, different interests like musician type, you know, music interests, ballet,
sports, you know, BMX, there's so much,
you know, cannabis. I mean, but then it's also like, what else is happening within that niche? And is your work going to really satisfy? And is it going to really, you know, and then there's that, you know, just building community around the film early on and knowing that if you're not going to have $100 million, you're going to need to spend a lot of time to reach, even though it's a more streamlined approach. I'm with you. We're all about niche, and our case studies mm-hmm. evidence that. Now, broad comedy, I mean.
$100,000 broad comedy with nobody in it.
Yeah, it's unless it's something that's going to go viral because it's so fun. But
those are outliers. Those are lottery tickets.
Those are the outliers. And if you're that talented that you can make that, then you're going to be successful, even if that movie isn't successful, because you're going to get discovered and you're going to become a comedy writer.
Right.
Right. Or comedy director, whatever.
Exactly. But, you know, the niche is the thing that I feel that low budget independent filmmakers have a chance. If you can make a series, and that's the thing now, right now is series. If you can create long form series, like even 6 episodes broken up, 20 minute episodes. That is more valuable right now in the marketplace. Would you agree?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I think the marketplace is looking for series, but at the same time, making a series that nobody consumes is also not useful. So
right.
if the work doesn't lend itself to be a series, but it really works as a film, then, you know, because that's a struggle. I think, you know, it's also like, it's not like all the platforms are just buying up every series that's available, right? They have their pick and they're buying very little relative to what's available, mm-hmm. right? Relative to how much they could buy. So, but I'm with you. Yeah, it's definitely a time for series. And if you have a series, that's what they want. That's a great thing. But there's plenty of docs. And I think in terms of comparing doc features to doc series, the good news is with docs, there's also so much financial support that is philanthropic that you can get your work made and have it be the right format for the work and not and then even have impact. I mean, we're all about distribution that is not about money making, but impact. We're launching a global VOD distribution initiative that is looking to philanthropic and corporate support to get movies out into the world for creating impact without it needing to generate revenue and have the support that came into making the film simply extend to releasing it. Mm-hmm. But back to the broad comedy, then there's no issue there, right? So it's like, we're back to like, what kind of content are you making and how are you going to find an audience for it? If it's an issue-oriented film, if there's a niche, these kinds of things, you can see a marketing plan. If it's just entertainment, I don't want to say just,
But it is just because there's like, I mean, I go on night and every night I go to Netflix, I got Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, Disney Plus. I go through them like, what am I going to watch tonight? And sometimes I literally watch because there's so much new stuff, but I can't. And please tell me what yours is. When you're scanning through your streaming services, if you see something that you're familiar with, either an actor or a genre, specifically an actor or a director or something like that, you'll feel more comfortable going to that because you just feel comfortable. That's why Adam Sandler has a career. He's one of the biggest stars on Netflix because anytime you skip by and you go, oh, that's an Adam Sandler movie, I know exactly what I'm going to get with an Adam Sandler movie. There's no surprises unless you're watching Punch Drunk Love. Other than that, it's generally – and that's why – and people might not admit it in public, but they're like, you know what? This is just going to be silly and funny. And like that new one he just did, Halloween, a Hoobie or whatever – huge. They're like going to make a sequel for it because it was such a big hit. But when you're going through, like for me to trust an unknown is tough for me. And even if I do give it a shot, I give them 5 minutes. And if they don't get me, I'm out. So that's why it's so difficult to stand out. As opposed in the 90s, do you think El Mariachi, Clerks, Slacker, Brothers McMullen, do you think they would ever find a voice today? Just, no way.
I agree with you. I agree with everything you've said. I do. One thing you didn't mention, I think, is also true. I'm sure for you too. Like Schitt's Creek, a show I would have never known about, heard about. But it's also because of a social media phenomenon or word of mouth. I do think there's that's happening now, which is like there's so many series. I mean, if I did nothing but watch the content available, I would run out of time before I died.
Of course.
And if I lived a very long life. So, you know, you just kind of like what's, you know, people are raving about this and that.
But yeah, no, they're all the platforms. All the platforms have their, I mean, look, and speaking of like niches, look at Disney Plus. Yeah. What Disney did is, I mean, we saw it coming and we all kind of felt like there's something here, but they just have killed it. They're taking over and they just released, I think a few weeks ago, that release that we're like, yeah, we're restructuring our entire business model for streaming.
Yeah.
Because they go, this is the future. This is where it all been. And you just heard yesterday they released that Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
On HBO for free on December 25th. That's a, what, $150 million film? I mean, wow. I know COVID has definitely fast-tracked all this stuff and forced us to do it. But,
yep.
I mean, the business model is solid.
Yeah, well, I mean.
It's different.
Nope. The technology is there, especially in this country, but it's also obviously developed in many other parts of the world and where people are home and it's working. And actually it's less expensive. It's less expensive than doing a theatrical campaign. So, you know, yeah, I'm with you. I have some Disney stock. I'm happy. Like, good.
Disney's doing well.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, and then there are the times when it's back to the COVID thing where an indie filmmaker, I mean, if you just think about like the filmmakers who got their careers because of having a short or a feature breakout at Sundance or they get discovered there. I do think that's another thing that's going to be challenging now is that discovery.
But the thing is though, and I've been kind of breaking down the Sundance myth for a while, is like, that doesn't happen as much anymore. It's not like in the 90s, it happened every month. I felt that there was a new story, a magical, mythical story. But now, like, I haven't heard of a lot of short filmmakers breaking out of Sundance. I know many Sundance winners who didn't make money on their films and they're still struggling to get their next gig. Like, it's not the automatic golden ticket that it was in the 90s, you know? Like,
I don't think it was an automatic golden ticket in the 90s. I just think there were enough successes that your odds were better than they are now. I definitely agree with you. It's definitely not that anymore. Now, on the happy note, there's so many more buyers than there have ever been, right? Right. And it's less expensive to make the work and less expensive to distribute it. And there's so many more buyers. And then there's also a real push for diversity. And I'm seeing my clients on the legal side, like people getting jobs that they might not have gotten in the past. Not that they didn't deserve it, but you know what I mean? Given opportunities that they were overlooked for, they shouldn't have been overlooked for. And I think that that's what's great now. So there's a plus side to everything.
Oh, no, absolutely. And there's so much more opportunity now. But this is what I feel, that a lot of filmmakers now, and I see this in my work on a daily basis, I see filmmakers making movies, producing films, thinking that the distribution landscape is set up like it was in the 90s. Like that's the business model is set up like, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to get this amount of money and there's these pre-sales. And like, it was tough in December 2019, it was tough, let alone now. Like now, nobody even knows.
The business plan literally looks like it was written in the 90s. Like I've seen that.
Right?
I mean, I worked for someone who, even in the 2000s, had a conception for the films that were way overblown, where like the budgets were twice as big as they should have been relative to how much money could be made. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think people need to adjust and they need to get honest. I mean, I do think that there's sometimes a willful blindness on the part of the filmmaking community because it needs to raise money and it needs to not feel, you know, like it's not doing the right thing. And then it just becomes, you know, and if you're investing in film, you just need to know that you might not see your money back and that's okay. As long as you know that and you're happy to support, people putting money behind film should be doing it not because they're going to get rich, but because they wanted to support the artists. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of an interesting model of invest in the artist for a period of time, right? Like imagine if you'd invested in, you know, Cary Fukunaga or Chris Nolan, like, you know what I mean? Like back in the day before when they first made their first films. I think that's another business model that I've just sort of fantasized about that I've never employed. But I do think that what you're talking about of people like just deliberately not inquiring as to what the economics of film are today is just...
It's foolish. Like, I mean, I talked to a filmmaker the other day who made $500,000 horror movie with one older horror star that only horror fans would know. And it was $500,000 movie. And they're like, where can I go? I'm like, you're never going to get that money back. Like, they have no audience.
Horror is a very glutted genre. I mean, I'm no horror expert, but when I've sold some horror in the past and the distributors will tell you there's a glut. I mean, there are deals to be done in the space.
But $500,000 for no stars. And it's like, it was well produced. It's like a well produced, nice horror. But that, I would go, look, if you could have made that movie for $175,000, you could probably make a profit, but you know,
right? I'll listen to something about it. I mean, I recently
again breakouts
that was about that level of deal, but it involved other elements. I think right. There's way too many of those movies. There's way too much of that content unless you have something that's going to break out and there's a reason that it's going to be special, and make that and generate that revenue. Because I mean, there are still pre-sales, but for cast-driven films.
It has to be cast driven.
And the genre stuff is also quite, I mean, it's still in demand, but there's so much of it that it's like there's a lot more that isn't sold than there is that is.
Yeah, without question. Now, we talked about TVOD. The SVOD world is pretty much I mean, people now, the Golden Goose is not DVD, but getting that Netflix deal and getting that Hulu deal or getting, you know, those kind of deals. And those are lottery tickets nowadays. I mean, again, Netflix isn't buying a whole lot of, I mean, you tell me better than it, but they're not buying a whole lot of, especially independent films. They stopped that for a while ago, right? And Amazon isn't either. You've got to have a very big cast. Yeah, you have to have a very big cast if they're even going to look at it.
Well, or you have something that they want to adapt to be something bigger, or you right. have something that fits a niche that tracks their data really well. I mean, they're very data driven. I mean, they're buying, but they're buying very, you know, I have a client whose movie they bought. There's also, you know, it's a global market for them. So there could be content that really works wouldn't work here necessarily, but is going to work in different parts of the world. That's a big, you know, a market that they're developing, right? So I don't want to completely undersell the ability to sell to Netflix, but it's certainly the case that, I mean, most movies out of most festivals, they will not buy. So that whole thing of like going to a good festival, even Sundance, you can go and not get sold at all, let alone to Netflix. So, and just being a tiny little movie without other clear elements that they're looking, I mean, because the best way to know about what Netflix wants is what Netflix has, right? What they just like, you know, scroll through everything they have that relates to your movie and see what it is. And then you'll, you know, I mean, obviously they could have stuff that's no longer tracking well, but they're very data driven. And, you know, I've sold to them before and yet I've been told no a bunch too. And there's no sales agent who hasn't been told no a bunch by them and right. by every single big platform.
No, I just want filmmakers listening to understand like that that's a goal, but that's not a business plan. There's no guarantee. There's not even a high probability. You have to, it's kind of like winning Sundance or getting into Sundance. Like the probabilities are hard. So you have to adjust that. You know, I always try to be real and raw about the truth hopefully with a positive swing, but I just don't, they're going to get, I think I've been saying this lately, like you're going to get punched in the face. Okay. Like we all get punched in the face in this business. We're all going to get it. It's the difference between I'm going to tell you I'm going to punch you in the face and you're seeing the fist coming to you slowly or getting cold cocked. That's how, and I just want you to be prepared for it when you get to it. Cause I've got a lot of shrapnel as I'm sure you do as well in this business.
Yeah. No, and it's been nice to hear you talk about your sort of tough talk. Cause I actually am the same, very, you know, straight talking New Yorker.
Yes.
Doesn't mince words, and sometimes I get thanked for being so honest. I often get thanked for being so honest, but I do think occasionally it's, you know, received as just sort of negative, and mm-hmm. I don't want to be that, but at the same time I really don't want to participate in any false, you know, assumptions and any puffing that is going to lead to people being disappointed later. So I rather err on the side of being a little tough. But, you know, I just yesterday had a conversation with someone who I was like, look, I don't see a big international potential for this. And they were explaining to me what they do. And I always say, I'd love to be wrong, but, and I really don't mean this in an ego way, but I rarely am. And I think when those words come out of my mouth, I don't think I've ever once been wrong where I've made a statement like about and then been proven. And part of it's also, people, they don't think of it in terms of, okay, like actually how many films are submitted to Sundance and how many are selected, how many films are pitched to Netflix, how many are selected and what are they buying? I talk about, you know, whether this film will work internationally, like what does that actually mean? Like how, you know, the buyers need to buy it in order for the audiences to be given the opportunity to see it. And is that likely? How many American films are they buying in the first place? What types? At what prices? And it's that kind of stuff that people are—they're not looking at the business of it all, right? Not and the math behind it, like the sheer volume of competition. And what they're doing is focusing on all the positive press that they've read over the years of people just being, you know, their film.
The lottery tickets.
But they haven't thought about all the entrance, right? All the tickets that weren't winners.
Lottery ticket. Look, I always say every week someone wins the lottery, but every week millions of people don't, and they only show you the lottery ticket winner, and that's what they show up because that's the good marketing. If they just said, "Oh, another 200 million people didn't win the lottery this week," no one would buy a lottery ticket.
And a lifelong amount of money spent by people pursuing that and not never getting it, right? How many people could have been better off saving that money and getting interest on it, or even investing it in the stock market?
Buying a house and renting it. Like, I mean, there's, look, if you're in this business, this is not a money making. I mean, it is, but there are so many other places that are better suited to generate revenue. You're in this because you love it. And you have a spark of madness in you. I mean, we all are a bit crazy just to be in this business. And the ones that we, like you and I, have been in it for, you know, many years, we should be certifiable at this point, because there's no excuse. We know better. But for people young coming in, you know, you have to be a little mad. And that's okay, because this is an artistic medium and artists are crazy in the first place. And you have to look at things differently and you have to be outside the box, and you have to, because that's what makes art art. But I feel that, you know, you were saying something earlier that triggered a thought in my head, which was filmmakers are taught in film schools and by Hollywood that you need to worry about the craft, and they teach you how to bake the cake, but they have no idea. They never teach you how to sell the cake. They never teach you how to build a bakery that actually is profitable. They just show you, like, look at the cool fondant. Look at the
also a business, right? They're also a business. If they told you that all the tuition you were paying to film school might be a big fat risk. But I'll also say this, I'm never surprised anymore by the power of a passionate filmmaker. Mm. I do think, you know, it's important to combine the passion with empowered knowledge and be real. But when people are absolutely obsessed with getting success, they often do. It just might not be exactly the version that they thought initially, right? The Netflix thing is not going to just happen like that. But I will say there is something to be said for, I mean, especially when they're talented. I mean, the intense passion without any talent is a little bit not great. But if you're very talented and you're very passionate, you know, often, more often than not, good things will come from that. It's just maybe not exactly how you first envisioned. I also want to be clear about you know, just back to Netflix. I mean, I worked at a distributor with a distributor that sold to Netflix before they even had a streaming service. There was a great boon back then, because similar to the, you know, model of the retail stores buying physical media, they were buying stuff just to have it to offer to build their business. So every so often there's a new version of that, right? There, you know, VHS and then DVD and then Blu-ray and then VOD. And there was a window of time where there was a lot of business being done just because the business was being built up and people needed stuff. It's just that we've passed that. And the question is now, what's next? Because it's hard to imagine yet another thing. And like Quibi was in an interesting experiment that obviously failed. And I think it was probably destined to fail regardless of the pandemic, but then the pandemic happened. And I do think that, you know, on the positive side, there is kind of these, like, every 10 years or whatever, every number of years, another kind of boon in the business that keeps things going. And another boon of people willing to invest in it, right? It was like real estate people, dentists, I'm forgetting the order, .com people, right? There's like new boons of people. It's a sexy, attractive space to be in. Crazy people attracted to it all the better. But not, all, you know, where are you in that landscape, right? In terms of, so I guess what I'm getting at is, I think people always find a way to get their movies financed and made. Mm-hmm. And then they always find a way to get them distributed to some extent, but they do need to be, I think they need to be real about not to assume that it'll come from an easy A-list festival acceptance and an easy big SVOD deal.
Right. Or just an easy distribution deal, which there is no such thing as an easy distribution deal.
Yeah, and many distribution deals these days are, yes, we'll take all your rights for 10 to 15 years and we'll give you no money up front and we will recoup expenses. And if it's successful, you'll make some money or not.
Maybe.
Right. Depends on the deal, right? Depends on their expenses and how much money they're allowed to recoup and what their distribution fee is and whether they're accounting honestly and accounting at all. All that, you know, I mean, listen, I've seen it all. I've seen people just stop accounting, you know?
Oh yeah. Or the hip pocket deals or cross collateralization. And there's so many little things that you can do in a deal to make sure you never get paid.
Middlemen that you didn't know existed, if mm-hmm. you weren't smart to figure it out, right? They actually don't do any VOD on them. This happened quite a bit where the companies didn't do the video on demand on themselves and someone else did, and that company took a fee and
And it just keeps going. You'll never make a dime. Or the with cross collateralization with the Walmart buybacks. Like, who's going to eat that? Not the distributor. You're going to eat that.
If that's in the contract, you're eating it.
You're eating it. Now, with what you were saying, like, there's always that next thing. I feel that it was TVOD, then it turned into SVOD. But I do believe now it's AVOD.
Yeah.
AVOD is the thing now that where filmmakers are making money. But if you notice, and everyone listening, from VHS to AVOD, the ROI has dropped substantially.
Oh. Also, it's because AVOD isn't like a – okay. So when Tubi, you know, launched, I mean, first it had, I think, films not even through licensing, but – you know, it was a boon. A lot of filmmakers got on there, and similar to what you're saying, like when you're early on the platform, there's going to be
a money.
Nice big check. And distributors who had, I mean, that's why distributors take, you know, rights for so long, because every time there's a new transition in the marketplace, they have a big basket to deliver, and you know, they get in early, they make money. So there were a lot of people that I think did well early on, but now they're getting just as selective, right? And the same stuff as that was true before. Just like with Netflix, where in the beginning it built up to, you know, curate for indie film lovers to get people to subscribe, didn't need to do quite as much of that. Same thing, right? All of a sudden, Tubi's focused on more commercial stuff. Not everything is going to get on there. Not everything is going to transact. Not everything's going to get on the homepage. You know, Amazon Prime was also a big boon for films for a while.
Well, yeah.
Well, Starz initiative was awesome. Then that was discontinued. Prime changed its rates right down to 1 cent. You know, it's so I think if you're a distributor, you're going to keep chasing where the money is and make a living because you have a lot of volume. Where you're the individual film, if you're not a commercial film or a film with a very clear niche, you're just not going to thrive.
But I mean, from the inception of the film industry to, let's say, the late 70s, early 80s, the distribution model was fairly the same. It didn't really change. You made a movie, you went out theatrical, you maybe redo a reissue every few years, and that was basically the way. And then maybe and then TV showed up, and then we could sell the rights to TVs, and there was foreign sales, but it was all fairly stable. Then VHS showed up, and that was the first kind of shift, really major shift. But then it was a slow, we're talking a decade, 15 years, then DVD. So as you notice, as the time goes on, the shift is much shorter. Now it's monthly.
But it's not, you're choosing to break out the VOD category with the types of VOD. And I will just say that really, if you think about it, TVOD is DVD, but less expensive.
Right.
SVOD is TV, but mm-hmm. in a different place.
Correct.
And AVOD is TV, but in a different place, right? AVOD is just the TV with ads, and SVOD is cable, you know?
Right. It's just online. It's just a different version of it. But I remember when AVOD was a dirty word. Like, you went to AVOD if you had nowhere else to go, and you had exhausted.
Right after you've done everything else.
Now it's a lot. I know distributors are going straight to AVOD. Like,
I think it depends on the movie. Yeah. Right. I think there's some films that are still doing it kind of traditional in that there is enough business potential to do transactional first, or there's enough of a big SVOD sale potential that's going to happen instead of AVOD. Mm-hmm. Or AVOD would happen only after that window, you know, but yeah, fair enough. Yeah. I think that's right. And that's why it's important to stay on top of what's happening in the business and where your film fits in with that. Right. So in other words, just hearing that AVOD's a big boon now, it's not for everything. So are you making a film that lends itself to that? And is it going to come out in time? You know? And then the other thing is there's a big surge in home entertainment revenue and VOD that's happening under COVID. Well, what's going to happen when there's a vaccine released and things shift, you know?
Again. Yeah, when things shift again.
Are people going to be like, okay, I was in my house for a year. Now I'm not. Turning on the, I doubt that's going
to
happen.
But, no, it won't. But that's a good question, though. So, do you think the theatrical, obviously, in business has completely been devastated? And even when we get out of COVID, and let's say within the next 12 months, 12 to 18 months, maybe completely out, back to somewhat of normalcy, many of those screens are going to be gone. They didn't make it during this time. So the screen capacity is going to be less, though I think someone will buy these screens and maybe do something with it. But do you think that it's going to get to where it was before? Because it was already going down. I mean, if you pull Marvel out of the last 10 years, there is the box office would be in a very bad shape. So it was definitely on a downward slope, but this just accelerated everything. Yeah. Do you think theatrical is going to be what it once was, even at 2019 levels?
No, I have no reason to think that. I do think that in the same way that we'll probably see a lot of flying happen after the pandemic is behind us, I do think that, you know, for the studio films, it'll be super glutted, that sure. There'll be a ton of business, great business for the studios. But for the independents, no, I think if anything, people will just have been trained to see that much more of that content, if at all, at home. And that there won't be a good enough reason to go out. I mean, I think festivals will still thrive and event screenings and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of the decline that was already happening to theatrical generally, especially for indies, there's no reason that should be reversed. Yeah. I don't see that at all. And it doesn't even make sense because, you know, a lot of the time the home experience, other than not being communal, is no worse technologically than depending on what theaters we're talking about.
Sometimes it could be superior.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, but I think the community experience of a festival and community screenings and event theatricals and all that stuff, especially that work for niches or issue-oriented films or certain kinds of communities, all that stuff will be, I think people wish it could be happening now. And it'll go back. But a theatrical indie hit that's like, oh, this tiny little $3 million movie generated way, way, way more times than its budget, I think that will be, it'll happen, but I think it'll be rare.
All right. Now, I have to ask you, can you give me an example of the best distribution deal that you've ever been a part of or seen and the most predatory that you're like, I can't believe this person is walking the earth?
Well, what I can say is I'm very proud of how much right splitting I did for one film. You know, we actually turned down, I'm not going to name the name of the film, sure. Because I don't want, but we turned down, in this case, it's very rare for me. I think it's the only time I turned down a worldwide Netflix deal to instead do a very significant television deal and another very significant VOD deal, both, you know, real money, and then an airline deal, and then a home video deal, and then additional educational distribution, and additional and then a number of territory sales additional television sales. So it was like so much right splitting that was successful, where mm-hmm. the film did festivals for over 2 years and made a whole bunch of money that way through Film Collaborative. And so that was where each distributor was willing to do what it did best and let everything else be carved out and have a really wonderful, robust combination of deals. And I've done that to different extents a few times before. Mm-hmm. I love the Giant Pictures deals of just 3 years. I think Giant is kind of a hybrid between aggregator and distributor. I don't think they would purport to do a ton of marketing, but they're not absentee about that. They're just sort of would partner with people on marketing. So I've done those deals that I think are wonderfully, like, beautifully filmmaker safe. You know, and then there's just a whole bunch of other in between, right? Where like, the distribution deal wasn't totally predatory, but it wasn't totally amazing, right? The distributor didn't like do incredible stuff, but there's other good deals that I've done over the years that I could say the distributor did everything that they said they would do. Now, in terms of, I mean,
the most predatory thing, you when you read it, you were just like, oh my god.
I mean, Green Apple's deal is predatory.
Oh, wow. You know? Okay. What is Green Apple?
Yeah. And I mean, maybe they'll sue me for saying it, but that's okay. I think it's predatory. Charging a marketing fee of $30,000, I think, is in their contracts.
Okay.
Taking right. I mean, it's that kind of thing to me when you have marketing fees. I mean, it's one thing for a sales agent to have a market fee saying, okay, instead of us doing this account, this complex accounting of figuring out exactly what, how to amortize, you know, how to prorate, we're just going to charge this thing. I still think you drill down into that and you don't just accept it at face value. But, you know, when you're just like taking filmmakers' rights without promising anything in return in terms of the degree of release, the marketing to be done, right? There's no actual commitment unless, you know, a lawyer made them change their contract, which I'm not sure they would. And you just, on its face, the contract is like, yep, we're taking your rights. We're going to bill back to a $30,000 marketing fee and not make any promises.
And how was the, what was the length of the, what's the length of the deal? 10 year?
I don't, because I never, I mean, my clients never did that deal with me having been their lawyer prior to that, but I've seen that deal after the fact, after people came to me after they signed it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like 10, I could double check, but it was more than 7. It was probably more like a 10 or 15 year deal. But even if it was, I'm almost positive it wasn't for 5 years. But the bottom line is, I've heard the filmmakers complain later, they're unhappy, right? Nothing that they were told was going to happen happened. And, you know, they're never going to see a penny because there's not enough money coming in to, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that the distributor isn't capable of distributing the films. I'm just saying the deal on its face is almost always going to be hideous for the filmmaker. And frankly, I don't even understand the logic behind simply charging that kind of a fee without doing the marketing, without having a real promise and commitment that's worth that.
Yeah, like, or break it down. Like, you know, like, we're going to buy $15,000 of Facebook ads, and we're going to get some billboards, and we're going to do this kind of thing.
I would bet money that that never happens, right? They never actually spend $30,000.
No, of course not. No, that's – well, and nowadays, like before, it was like, oh, we go to the markets. We go to Cannes. We go to Albuquerque. But no one's flying anywhere.
That's the other thing I'm seeing in sales agent deals, those same – you know, where I said it's not necessarily unreasonable – but you need to drill into it. It's like, you're not going anywhere. There's no flying. There's no booth. There's no nothing. It's never been less expensive to do sales in a, you know, because it's a virtual market. Not to say that that will stay forever, but that's the thing, is don't just sign these things. So, you know, and I tell filmmakers, the term is not, to me, the biggest issue. Not because I love doing long terms. I love Giant for their 3-year terms. But not to say that just because a distributor has a 7 or 10 or even 15-year term, that's so terrible, because there's a logic behind it from their perspective. But also, the value of the film, really, like a car, really goes down so fast, right? After it's been released, a year or two later, very few films are generating enough money for it to be that, for it to be the big thing.
So then why hold it for so many years?
Well, because of what I said earlier.
Right.
From the distributor's perspective, A, they will have spent money on it, so they want to not be at risk of not recouping and making money. But also because of that, then they have a nice life. Every time there's a new thing, they have a basket to start with. I mean, that's a good thing if you're a distributor. Like, Netflix launches, great. I've got 50 or 100 movies I can license to you. Tubi, great. Like, they're in the best position. If they didn't keep their rights for a long period of time, they wouldn't have that library, right?
But that's not helpful. Not helpful to the filmmaker. It's more helpful to them.
Well, it can be both. I mean, I don't want it to be so tilted.
Got it.
It can be helpful to the filmmaker in that Tubi's not coming to individual filmmakers or, right, you know, Netflix. I mean, or, you know, I'm not saying it never happens, but mostly these platforms, these new buyers are only going to go to a place where they can get a lot of content at once, not just one-offs, unless it's a really big one-off. And in that way, the filmmaker is helped because it's an opportunity that otherwise they wouldn't get. It's just a question of under what terms. And is their film going to be part of that? Or is it their film going to be, the question is, what happens when that film just isn't doing any business anywhere 5 years into the term? Will the filmmaker get their rights back? And the distributor will say no, because, you know, we still wanted the opportunity to keep monetizing to the extent possible. And is the distributor doing anything to keep giving life to that film after, you know, the first year of release? So these are the things to drill into. What are you getting for giving up the rights for that period of time? Are they committed to always pitching your film to every platform? Are they really marketing thoroughly?
Right. What are they doing?
To the consumers, all that stuff.
Yeah, I had a deal. I was consulting once, and they came to me with this deal, which was 20-year, $50,000 marketing fee yearly.
Oh, wow.
Yearly, yeah. 20-year. So she was like, oh, okay, so $1 million. So that's $1 million over the course of the term. So you'll never, ever going to see a dime. And then I go, let's just play a game. It was 25 years. 25-year term. And I go, let's push back. Let's see what happens. And we pushed back and they're like, oh, okay. 15 years and 10,000 a year. I'm like, what is this?
Yeah, it's in there. It's just in there. You know, and I, you know, some of the things I do understand from, like I said, I've been a distributor, but it's also true that even the distribution expenses, it was really expensive to make VHSs and DVDs.
Yeah.
Now it's not expensive to do VOD. It just isn't, right? I mean, I'm not saying it's free. I'm just saying it's hundreds of dollars or a few thousand. It's not per platform. It's not, you know, and
tens of thousands. Yeah.
And don't put my film on 100 platforms at my expense unless it makes sense. Like, are this film actually going to get onto those platforms and actually perform? So I think those are the things to look to. But I think it's important. This is part of what the distributor report card is meant to do, is not just only have red flags and also, you know, happy, you know, blue ones, whatever the color would be, for good and bad work on distributor's part, but to also have perspective on what, why things are the way they are and what you should push back on and what maybe isn't so necessary to push back on. You know, I will say, no one ever wants to be in a Q Media or Tug or distributor like scenario where you can't get your rights back when they become insolvent or file for bankruptcy. And similarly, I don't want to not be able to get my filmmaker's rights back if there's uncured material breach, you know. But if the distributor has done everything they said they would do and honored the contract, but you simply haven't made as much money as you hoped, I get that the distributor is not going to be happy to just hand you your rights back.
Right. There's a balance. There's a balance with everything. Now, can you tell me really what is Film Collaborative and what is it? What do you do with it? What's the work you do with it?
It's a nonprofit that is focused on educating filmmakers about film distribution, facilitating film distribution without taking their rights. I founded it at the end of 2009. We launched officially in 2010. And we have a lot of educational information on the website and in our books about distribution. I recommend folks go to thefilmcollaborative.org. Some of those resources I've mentioned earlier today. Speaking of research, we have something called Resource Place. Anyway, we have all that free educational information about distribution, and we also have membership consulting services for folks if they want, like, you know, one-on-one or one-on-two, let's say two of us, to watch the film and to advise about it, or three of us, it depends. We do festival distribution, I think, better than anyone. We, you know, help with the festival strategy. We submit the films to programmers that we know personally. There's no cold submission. There's no paying to submit. And we also monetize the films on the festival circuit that can sometimes generate six figures, sometimes more often than not, five figures, that we share that money with the filmmakers. And we're never taking rights. So any deal that's done with us can be canceled at any time. And we also do sales, but in a very, very boutique fashion. So I don't want to oversell the sales practice. But we can definitely help with that service of pitching the right places and helping them do the deal and collaborate with the sales agent. Like, we also play well with others. So if we provide a distribution service, but you're also working with, you know, you name it, the sales agency, or you want help doing international sales, which I don't do anymore very often, on purpose, you know, we'll pair you with folks that we think are trustworthy. So we basically can help with every single aspect of distribution, to one extent, or, you know, either completely or in part without taking rights. And we're launching the TFC Global VOD Impact Initiative that I mentioned earlier, which is, that's going to be documentary focused. And that is going to be taking films that really are meant to have an impact around the world, that are, you know, meant to educate and inspire and impact, and getting them widely distributed, including on VOD platforms around the world. There's like 3,000 VOD platforms just in Europe. I'm not saying the film needs to be on all of them. I'm just saying there's a whole world out there that's not just the big SVODs that, you know, and TVODs and AVODs that we know of in the States. Having films reach audiences around the world with a goal of impact, not revenue generation, and have the revenue come from philanthropy and corporate support.
Very cool. I'm so glad there's something like you in the world. And I love to spotlight that kind of stuff. I've been... you know, I've been fighting the good fight over here for a while now. And I'm glad that there's other Avengers out there. We have to unite to take down predatory distributors and educate filmmakers as much as possible on the process. I know I was just talking to a filmmaker yesterday, like, Alex, you saved me from going with distributor. Like, I was literally about a day away from submitting and paying when you came out with your podcast and broke that story. And I'm like, oh my God, I mean, you have no idea how that makes me feel. And being able to help filmmakers get their rights back or get their money back from that whole situation was so rewarding. But it is, you know, I tend to be sometimes a little bit too raw and too brutally honest, but I feel that the business is brutal and I'd rather you hear it from me than you lose $500,000 on the movie that you borrowed your money or least, you know, took a loan out on your house for, which I'm sure you've heard those stories and I have too.
Oh, definitely. No, I totally agree with you. And I think what you did there was great. And we had a distributor-like service, and I'm really glad that we did not do to filmmakers or distributor did, but it made me rethink even our service to make sure, because we were working with another service provider transparently mm-hmm. and a less expensive version of the exact same service than distributor. But I never want to be in that place if I don't have total control to make sure that they never get harmed. So we've adjusted that too, you know, yeah. And it's, what you're doing is great. And, you know, I think the thing is, at the end of the day, if filmmakers just get the knowledge ahead of time, right. They can make a choice. They can make a choice to proceed anyway, even knowing they might not make the money back or, you know, knowing they might not be discovered and become an A-list director, but at least know that what's possible and what it takes to get there and then, you know, enjoy it. Enjoy the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate everything you do at the Film Collaborative and fighting the good fight for the last 10 years now, plus working and helping filmmakers. So I appreciate you and thank you so much for coming on the show and dropping the knowledge bombs on the tribe today. So I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for hosting me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun. Good luck to everybody. Stay well.
I want to thank Orly for coming on the show and dropping those distribution knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Orly. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to reach Orly, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/444. And if you haven't already, head over to ifhtv.com and check out the world's first streaming service dedicated to filmmakers and screenwriters. We have over 2,200 videos there to help you on your filmmaking journey. Just head over to ifhtv.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.